You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio, 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Casey Kuhn.
And I'm Chris Martin. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, September 16th, 2014.
I would be hopeful that Bloomin' Foods would be reaching out to me soon, but there seems to be a lot of community support that they do remain neutral and they keep in line with their seven policies of governance.
WFHB continues to follow efforts of Bloomin' Foods employees to unionize. More later in the show in today's community report.
Also coming up in the newscast, early voting hours and continued environmental effects of I-69. But first, your daily headlines.
The national debate about militarized police forces continues as awareness grows about local campus police acquiring surplus military gear. The Indianapolis Star reports that Indiana University is one of at least five campus police departments that have received surplus military gear in the last 4 years. Surplus gear can include body armor, military vehicles, and M14 or M16 rifles. Recent incidents of lone assailants creating public massacres using high-powered weaponry has raised concerns about police and campus resources. Yet, after the much-publicized shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown by Ferguson, Missouri police, lawmakers held congressional hearings last week on the subject. Claire McCaskill, Democratic senator from Missouri, called for limits to programs that supply police with military equipment. According to reports obtained at the IU Department of Administration, Bloomington campus police have received 6 M16 rifles as well as helmets and bulletproof vests. Officer Jerry Minger, who oversees 7 campus police departments at Indiana University, says the rifles have been modified so they are not fully automatic. He claims they are appropriate for campus police force use. Minger is quoted in the Star saying, "Police departments are typically not warriors. They're typically guardians of a community. How do you protect the community if you don't have the appropriate equipment to do so?" Herb Terry, former president of Indiana University Faculty Council, says he trusts the IU campus police will use discretion with the armory and suggested the thing to monitor might be the people wielding the weapons, not the weapons themselves, saying he does not believe the IU Police Department is over-militarized.
Same-sex couples in Indiana are still not able to marry, at least until the Supreme Court addresses the case later this month. Yesterday, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals approved a stay on same-sex marriage in Indiana. The stay is holding the lower court's ruling from September 4th that the same-sex marriage ban in Indiana is unconstitutional and will be held until dealt with by the U.S. Supreme Court. On June 25th, same-sex marriage was temporarily legal after a ruling by U.S. District Court Judge Richard Young. 2 days later, the Seventh Circuit Court ordered an emergency stay to same-sex marriages. On September 29th, the Supreme Court will address the case in a closed-door conference to either hold or lift the ban.
Last Thursday, the Board of Directors of Jill's House voted to shut the organization down. Jill's House is a nonprofit house with over 25 rooms for cancer patients to live during treatment. The organization opened in 2008 and has been home to over 600 patients. It will be closing on December 31st, the same day that the IU Health Protron Therapy Center is closing. IU Health officials have said the facility is closing due to financial deficit. Jill's House was founded by the parents of Jill Berman, who was abducted in 2000 while bike riding near her home. Berman's parents created the nonprofit with the parents of Stephen Howard, who died of cancer at the age of 19. IU announced earlier this month that it was not financially viable to continue to operate the Protron Therapy Center.
Free furnace inspections, cleanings, and repair will be offered on Bring the Heat Day, October 11th, through a volunteer partnership between Bloomington's Housing and Neighborhood Development Department and the Heating and Air Conditioning Alliance of Indiana. From 8 a.m. until noon, Bring the Heat Day volunteers will supply resources to conduct up to 50 furnace inspections and repairs for owner-occupied gas furnace residents of Monroe County. The day is designed to raise awareness for the life-saving importance of proper furnace maintenance. Applications for Bring the Heat Day are available at 401 North Morton Street, Suite 130, and can be picked up or returned Monday through Friday between 8 and 5 p.m. The application deadline is September 26th.
Early and absentee voting hours for Monroe County residents will begin on Tuesday, October 7th at the Election Center at 401 West 7th Street in Bloomington. Ruth Hickman, Monroe County Election Supervisor, announced the office will be open Tuesdays through Fridays from 8:30 a.m. to 6 p.m., with times increased after October 24th to accommodate voters. A public test of electronic and ballot voting equipment will be held next Tuesday at 9 a.m. in the Monroe County Election Center. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Chris Martin.
And I'm Casey Kuhn. Support for the Daily Local News comes from Smithville, a local provider of internet, phone, and TV service over a stabilized fiber optic network, serving Monroe, Greene, Owen, Lawrence, Brown, and Morgan counties. More information on Smithville's full line of services is available at 812-876-2211 or smithville.net.
More than 15 months after the issue first surfaced, Interstate 69 construction is still damaging waterways in Monroe County. That's according to members of the Bloomington Monroe County Metropolitan Planning Organization's Policy Committee. At a meeting September 12th, committee member Scott Wells showed photos of brown tap water and streams contaminated with sediment. Wells said local officials need to keep pressure on the State Department of Transportation.
I think part of the reason, from what I've heard from people, is we've just pulled a discussion because we're concerned that, you know, since the leverage of getting money comes from the people above us, NDOT et al., and some other people, that if we keep talking about it, you know, some of our funding might be pulled. So it's kind of just vanished.
Wells said a family in the southeastern part of the county recently lost their drinking water. He presented pictures showing sediment-filled water coming out of their faucets.
This is their tap water now. This is August 22nd of this year. Imagine you come home from a hard day and you're ready to have some dinner or something and you turn on your water faucet. That's not drinkable. That's unacceptable. The erosion control. Next picture. There it is. There's your drinking water. This is the second situation now out there. To sit here and not talk about it. Yeah, politician, yeah, we better not talk about it because we want to make sure we get our money or whatever. I'm talking about it because these are friends of mine. This is the county council district where I live in. And I think it's important. It's not whether you're a politician, whether you're Democrat or Republican. It's about we got to fix these problems.
Contractors working on I-69 have been cited numerous times for not controlling erosion. Local officials have sent official complaints to state and federal regulators, but committee member Andy Ruff says NDOT hasn't followed up on promises to deal with the issue.
What people in general need to understand is that Indian Creek, which is a state-designated high-value stream, of national significance and international significance, actually as a karst stream. It's been written in scientific geological papers as an example of a stream that has sinks and springs and swallow holes. The stream has been sacrificed in the name of this project.
The committee has repeatedly asked NDOT to respond to specific concerns about contamination, but the state has never done that, at least not in a public meeting. Tony McLennan, a deputy commissioner with NDOT, said the agency won't talk with the committee about the problem because it's occurring outside of the MPO's jurisdiction.
I and the department cannot control what's discussed on this particular policy committee. I wouldn't want to dream of trying to do that, but what I can tell you is that the Department of Transportation will not respond, especially to these kind of complaints in this meeting when they're in regards to Section 4. If they're within the policy's jurisdiction, we can discuss that and we'll look at ways to address. But even then, this is not the proper form for this.
Although the current contamination is beyond the MPO's jurisdiction, committee members worry similar problems might persist as construction moves through Bloomington. Committee member Cheryl Munson said she hopes NDOT is sincere in its promises to handle complaints through other channels.
Since Mr. McGowan said the project manager and the customer service representatives for NDOT Section 4 and Section 5 are the people to contact in the interest of serving the public of Monroe County, I hope their phone numbers, names, phone numbers, and emails will be publicized. And you may not be prepared to give those to us now, but I would like you to give them to the MPO office, and I would like to know them, actually. And I hope they would be available to the Herald Times so that the public knows who are the right people to call when they have a problem.
McLennan did not immediately respond to Munson's request.
Blooming Foods employees are hoping and expecting their managers to remain neutral during the effort to organize into a union. Last week, the Daily Local News reported on indications that workers at the retail grocery cooperative were trying to unionize. During that report, we conveyed some parts of our conversation with Cindy Bolle, a former employee of Blooming Foods, about working conditions and labor management relations at the organization. She mentioned that there had been two prior unsuccessful attempts by employees to organize, and that she was not surprised that another effort is now underway. Yesterday, we spoke to Kaisa Goodman, a member of the Worker Organizing Committee, who confirmed that she and others had scheduled a meeting later in the day with Scott Bardet, an organizer with Local 700 of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Bardet confirmed by phone this morning that he had met with some of the workers and was meeting again today with others. He then went on to talk about the position that the owner members and the management would take during the union drive.
Right now, there seems to be a community member owner support in neutrality. And we've always asked that Blooming Foods remain neutral in this process.
A poster with Local 700's logo on a pole across the street from Blooming Foods' West Side outlet claimed that the co-op had hired a, quote, union-busting lawyer, quote, unquote, from an Indianapolis firm.
Yes, that is correct. We have verified that. I can't give you my source on that, but I can just say that has been verified. And we're kind of still waiting. I would be hopeful that Blooming Foods would be reaching out to me soon, but there seems to be a lot of community support that they do remain neutral and they keep in line with their seven policies of governance.
Bardet refers to the basic principles of cooperatives that are posted on the website of Blooming Foods. These state that cooperatives are based on the values of self-help, self-responsibility, democracy, equality, equity, and solidarity. In the tradition of their founders, cooperative members believe in the ethical values of honesty, openness, social responsibility, and caring for others. Bardet says he asked Blooming Foods management to meet with him to talk about their position. He then explained what stage of the organizing drive the workers were at currently.
We've been signing up the process is that they sign authorization cards, okay? And we are still in that process of signing those cards at this time. We've had an overwhelming response. It's been a great response.
Under the National Labor Relations Code, card signing precedes a union certification vote. The Daily Local News has left several phone messages with management and the board of directors of Blooming Foods asking them to comment on the union drive and their response to it, but have not received any response yet. A September 15th blog post by local activist Dan Bingham cites an email response from Blooming Foods board president Tim Clower, which reads in part, quote, "Like you, we really care about our co-op, the employees, the members, and our community. We recognize the rights of co-op employees to consider whether they want to join a union or refrain from joining a union. We are resolved to respect co-op employees' decision on the issue, whatever it might be," end quote. A solidarity rally to support Blooming Foods workers has been scheduled for Thursday, September 18th at 4:30 at the Blooming Foods Near West Side store.
Pawn shops in Ellisville now have to send their sales data to the town police at the same time they provide it to a nationwide law enforcement database. The town council passed second-hand dealer regulations late last year. Afterwards, there was dispute about how quickly businesses must report certain information. Town Attorney Darla Brown proposed an amendment to the new ordinance September 8th.
And the purpose of the change to pawnbrokers 2014-13 was to add a paragraph to 11.06A that requires the licensee to transfer information about the articles pawned to a law enforcement website within 24 hours of the licensee receiving the article pawned.
Similar rules apply to stores that buy and sell valuable metals. Last December, the council passed the law forcing the shops to report their sales to a private company that shares information with police across the country. The goal is to help solve cases of theft, but some residents worry about sharing the data could compromise the privacy of customers. You're listening to the Daily Local News. I'm Chris Martin.
And I'm Casey Kuhn. Support for WFHB comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli, your locally grown co-op grocery since 1976. Blooming Foods features natural, organic, local, and fair trade food and garden items with support for small farmers, co-op producers, and local food artisans. Blooming Foods Market and Deli on 2nd and Fess at Elm Heights, on East 3rd near College Mall, West 6th near the Courthouse Square, and right up your alley at Kirkwood and Dunn.
Again, you've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Supported by Smithville, your Indiana communications company at smithville.net. And by Blooming Foods Market and Deli, your locally grown co-op grocery. Today's headlines are written by Kathy Norton, David Murthy, and Daniel Flum, along with Joe Crawford for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services.
Our board engineer is Carissa Barrett. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Managing producer is Joe Crawford. Executive producer is Allison Bechtesh. For WFHB, I'm Casey Kuhn.
And I'm Chris Martin. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. Recognized among the best newscast and breaking news coverage in 2013 by the Indiana Professional Chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. Send inquiries to news@wfhb.org. Stay tuned for Interchange, Bloomington Community Radio's longest-running public affairs program, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.